2 years ago when Russia launched the largest military invasion in Europe since World War II. Most of the world thought that Ukraine had no chance.
Russia's launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine from the north, east, and south.
No chance to defend itself.
Shelling and missile strikes have been reported in cities across Ukraine, which has also come under an intense cyber attack.
No chance to last more than even a few days. But as we now know, Ukraine shocked the world.
Across Ukraine, people are volunteering to help in the war effort. Some are signing up for the security forces, some are preparing meals. Others are helping people who evacuate from Russian-controlled territory to find transportation and places.
It came together quickly as a people, pulled together an army and a nation to back it up, and managed to push back Russian advances. And all of this happened before the United States began sending its sophisticated weaponry. It was an extraordinary event. And 2 years later, Ukraine continues to fight.
300,000 soldiers are determined, but exhausted, outmanned, and increasingly outgunned. In some areas, for every artillery shell they fire, Russian soldiers fire 10.
Since that extraordinary moment, when Ukraine beat the odds, I've wondered, what was behind that? How did that nation come together so quickly and so powerfully and do what nobody thought possible? I wanted to know the backstory. And I knew there must be a backstory, because the sense of camaraderie and resilience that Ukrainians have shown the past 2 years could not have appeared out of thin air. These things come from somewhere, but where? What had happened in Ukraine in the years between when it gained independence from the Soviet Union and the full-scale Russian invasion of 2022? These were my questions. Fortunately, I found someone with good answers. His name is Valerie Pekar. Today, Valerie is one of Ukraine's most thoughtful and influential civic activists. He has advised the country's leaders about political and economic reform, taught at a top business school, run multiple companies, and written deeply studied and strategic essays about Ukraine's war with Russia. The story that he tells is about Ukraine as a nation, how it has grown politically, economically, and culturally in recent decades. It's also about Valerie himself and the many ways he has grown as a human being in parallel with the changes happening in his country. We begin this story in the 1980s, when Valerie was a student in Ukraine, which was then part of the Soviet Union.
Soviet Union looked as a very progressive, at least in its propaganda, which cares about science, technology, development, progress, anti-colonialism, and so on. But in fact, Soviet Union was a very traditional society with a classical feudal hierarchy, with a state-owned industry and economics, with a very feudal imperial identity of people. And this imperial identity meant that people should not feel themselves Ukrainians, Estonians, or Georgians. They would rather feel themselves Soviet people. But in the late 80s, dramatic shifts were felt in the society, probably after Chernobyl.
In the last couple of days, there's been perhaps the worst accident in the short history of the world's nuclear power industry.
The response from the Kremlin was silence and neglect.
And after a Soviet invasion to Afghanistan,
the 40th Army, numbering 80,000 men now, but rising in time to 152,000, one-third the strength of United States forces at their peak in Vietnam.
Which was absolute failure from all points of view. People felt themselves more members of their own a republic, of their own national community, and understood that this huge empire could not be modernized, simply could not be modernized. It would be traditional all the time, all the way.
This is How My View Grew, the show that dives deep into humanity's challenges by looking at big thinkers who have changed their minds. I'm Amiel Handelsman. Valerie Pekar first came to my attention a half dozen years ago at a conference I attended in Central Europe. He was part of a Ukrainian delegation. And as I hung out at the conference for a few days, it was pretty clear to me that all the other Ukrainians considered him the biggest thinker of the group, the strategist, the visionary, the one who could describe what was happening, why it was happening, and what was possible in the future. And that's why I wanted to bring him on to answer my question about the Ukrainian people. What in their past experience had prepared them, after Russia's full-scale invasion, to come together in such a surprising and extraordinary way? How had they grown? And how, as one Ukrainian who was at the center of all this, had Valerie grown? Now we return to Valerie's experience in the late 1980s as the Soviet Union was falling apart.
The empire was deconstructed and 15 new states appeared. They started their own ways. All ways were very different indeed. Baltic countries, for instance, became very soon members of European Union and NATO.
These Baltic countries and others like Poland had a recent tradition of being independent states, but not Ukraine.
Ukraine was stateless for centuries and centuries, and that way was hard enough, and it took one generation to understand how to build their own state. Many people outside Ukraine thought during that hard time that Ukrainians were stateless so long that they could not build their own state. They never could do this.
Yet, within Ukraine, the people's opposition to empire and that idea of Ukraine was always present.
The very idea of Ukraine survived. It survived through mass murder of Ukrainian public intellectuals, artists, writers, poets in late 30s. It survived Second World War. It survived next famines post-war, and then survived all other problems of Soviet Union, including Chernobyl. And the idea of Ukraine survived all those things.
I asked Valerie how in the late 1980s and early 1990s he viewed the idea of Ukraine as an independent and sovereign state. His answer surprised me.
For me personally, and for some other people, the key word was modernization.
Valerie thought the Soviet Empire was too large and stuck in its ways to modernize. But for a smaller Ukraine, modernization was possible. And for Valerie, when the empire broke up, this meant doing something that had been illegal in the Soviet Union, starting a business.
And one of the first decrees of first Ukrainian government was to allow private entrepreneurship. And people like me, young people with a good profession, immediately started to think about that. So I was from a part of the first wave of private entrepreneurship in Ukraine. Just few months or few weeks, maybe even after the decree of free private entrepreneurship, I founded my first business. That was at that time a publishing house.
How did your view of your own life opportunities and career change when the Soviet Union dissolved and Ukraine declared independence twice, I believe? And you started this business.
Everything was new. So all rules of the game disappeared. We dreamed about freedom, about prosperity, about human rights, about liberalism, and we got it. That is why so many small enterprises were founded at that time. So freedom in choosing with whom to speak, with whom to meet, with whom to do business, which numbers should be in your mobile phone and which numbers should be removed from your mobile phone, who are your friends and who are not. All these things were absolutely impossible during communist rule in Soviet Union because you were obliged to take this job. You have no choice. You are obliged to have this kind of colleagues, to have this kind of boss. You cannot change your job. You cannot change your profession.
This thirst for freedom showed up in political choices the Ukrainian people made. In August 1991, after a failed military coup in Moscow, the Ukrainian parliament declared independence. When Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev pushed back against this, Ukrainian leaders decided to hold a referendum on Ukrainian independence.
But the union is now breaking up without him. This pro-independence rally in the Ukraine was just another example of the mood of separatism sweeping the nation.
And the referendum was on December 1st, 1991. And it was extremely important that in whole Ukraine, including its eastern regions, its southern regions, more than 80% voted for independence. And even in Crimea, more than 50% voted for independence.
Were you surprised?
Everybody was surprised. Were surprised because, for instance, Russian leaders of that time thought that in many regions, people will vote not for independence, will vote against it, and they would ask Ukraine to transfer these regions from Ukraine to Russia. But since in all regions, people voted for independence, Russian leaders decided to postpone this demand. And so one of the myths of Putin is that people in some regions of Ukraine don't want to live in independent Ukraine. It was never true because people voted in 1991 for independence. And since that time, all sociological polls proved that the popularity of the idea of independent Ukraine and living in independent Ukraine just increased all the time.
I asked Valerie how this massive vote for independence influenced his view of Ukraine's future as a nation and state. Once again, his answer surprised me.
My personal feeling that time was concentrated rather on me, because to be a modern person rather than traditional is to be more, I'm sorry to say, individualistic than collectivistic. Life in Soviet Union was collectivistic enough. So the general motto was you should think about the country and only after that about you. You should think about people around you and never think about you. You should forget your own interests and sacrifice your own interests to the ideas of the community and so on. So that's traditional worldview is very collectivistic. And it was supported by mass propaganda, by movies, books, and poems and so on. And this switch in personal worldview, indeed, it was a switch to a more individualistic way. So during the 90s and even first decade of the new millennia, I thought more about me, my colleagues, my employees, my family, indeed, my friends and partners and so and communities.
Valerie went to business school and founded several more companies.
So I could call me that time a serial entrepreneur.
This was Valerie's experience when the Soviet Empire fell and when Ukraine became free. He was an early adopter of a major shift in worldview that his country would begin to go through. He grew his view from a traditional worldview where you sacrifice yourself to a higher authority to a modern worldview where you assert your individuality and explore what it means finally to be free. And yet, neither his individual growth nor his country's was over. Far from it.
One day a person feels that it's more or less enough and something new is necessary.
It was time for another major shift.
So in my business school, as a lecturer, as a professor, I see people like me that time. I see people who already are full of experience in their private businesses.
We're now in the year 2010, 2 decades after Ukraine's independence.
They don't want to stop their businesses, indeed. They don't want to break their career and to sell everything and go to, I don't know, Himalaya. But they would like to do more. They would like to turn to communities and to do something with social impact. This was an internal shift. And that is why the motto of my business school, change yourself, change the country, change the world. And what is important, you cannot change this sequence.
In the 2 decades since Ukraine's independence, Valerie and his students had shifted from the traditional worldview, where the individual sacrifices themselves to a larger system, in this case, the Soviet Union, to a modern worldview, where individuals have freedom to think, act, make money, and create their lives. What he's describing here is a second and very different shift, which Valerie calls
Revolution of Dignity.
The Revolution of Dignity happened in 2014. But first, a bit of context.
To understand this great shift, it is necessary to zoom out and look to the modern history of Ukraine. So it was not the first revolution. It was third revolution in modern political history, because first revolution was in 1991. Second revolution was so-called Orange Revolution in 2004, a revolution when Moscow tried to steal elections in Ukraine and to introduce its that time puppet leader. The leader which people voted for was poisoned.
Mr. President, do you know who did this to you specifically?
Безумовно, це ми зробили мої опоненти від влади.
I have no doubt this was done by my opponents in the government.
So the idea was to stop Ukrainians move into the Western direction, to Europe, to European choice, to European values, and to turn it to the East, to Russia, and to make it a country which is dependent from Russia, from Moscow. A good example of what Moscow wanted that time to transform Ukraine into is Belarus.
Russia wanted then to be able to control Ukraine just as now, in 2024, it controls Belarus, which has a puppet government that takes orders from Moscow. But in 2004, the Ukrainian people did not want this. So they took to the streets.
Hundreds of thousands of people went to squares and streets to protest against stealing elections. And that time we won. And then imagine 10 years left, and again, we had something like that. Our choice could be stolen. The choice of the whole country was to sign an association agreement with the European Union.
We've now fast-forwarded a decade to 2014. At this time, Ukrainians considered this association agreement an important step to forming closer ties with Europe. The Ukrainian president at the time, Viktor Yanukovych, had promised to sign the agreement, but at the last minute, under great pressure from Putin, he refused.
So imagine that hundreds of thousands of people appeared on the street. It was not a revolution that moment, just a demand to deliver the promise. But within a few days, there was a brutal beating of young students exactly on that Maidan, again, the same central square of Kyiv. And that was the start of revolution because something like 1 million people filled the square and streets around. No one political leader could resist to such a pressure of his nation. That was a real third revolution, a revolution of dignity. And if first transition from traditional to modern happened under the motto of, under the aegis of freedom, the key word for second transition was dignity. Freedom wasn't enough.
Dignity. And the president fled. We need to just, you said it was a success. The president fled the country, Yanukovych.
So the success was not only that he fled, yes, this flu was accompanied by a murder of around 100 people on Central Square, but the free elections with the then signing of agreement of association agreement with the European Union. That was the key.
But the Ukrainian Revolution of Dignity in 2014 was, like similar efforts before it, unacceptable to Moscow.
Because that means that Ukraine finally made its final and ultimate choice of European values and never could be again a part of the empire. Scholars say, primarily, it was my idea, which I delivered, speaking from the scene of Maidan, that Maidan was three-in-one revolutions.
When Valery says scene, he means stage. It was from the stage of the Maidan, surrounded by hundreds of thousands of people, that he delivered a speech outlining the three revolutions Ukraine was going through.
It was an economic revolution of new middle-class urban professionals, which would like to live not in post-Soviet, post-feudal system, but in a liberal economy. So it was something like revolutions in Western European countries when the middle class and third class, urban bourgeoisie and so on came into power and say old privileges, old feudals are obsolete and we should eliminate their power. Second, it was a geopolitical revolution. Because the country made its final break with Soviet tradition, with imperial tradition, and made its choice to towards European and Euro-Atlantic integration, to be a part of Europe, and finally, our aspiration of European and Euro-Atlantic integration was included into our constitution. And third revolution was a mental revolution from modern worldview, individualistic, to that which you could say a postmodern progressive worldview, where people should think about each other, people should care about each other, people should create specific social systems and networks to help each other to be successful and happy. Indeed, it was extremely idealistic system of worldview that together we could help to each other to be happy and everybody would be happy in the country which respects human dignity.
Valerie is describing a major shift of view that he and his business students had started going through in 2010, and that now the country was beginning in 2014 through the Revolution of Dignity. This is not a shift from a traditional to a modern worldview, which they had gone through before, but instead from a modern to a progressive postmodern worldview. What was your personal experience recognizing that you had already shifted from yourself, from being individualistic to moving into social impact, had already started for several years at least supporting business people, business students, and doing that? And then you have this revolution of dignity. How is that affecting you?
So I was explaining, predicting, establishing together with some friends, so-called Open University of Maidan, a civic education project.
The Open University of Maidan was the catalyst for a great deal of positive change that would then occur in Ukraine. It energized citizen leaders. One of them was Valerie. After telling his business colleagues he would be out of the office for a few weeks, he ended up staying out for 4.5 years.
We thought and discussed what kind of country should be built after the revolution. We started to discuss this with experts, get together some people with economic, political science, social science competences, and so on. And finally, we involved more than 1,000 people into different dialogues. What kind of country should we do? What reforms should we do? And so on.
These exchanges that Valerie is describing reflect a particular type of conversation. Actually, I'd say there are two types of conversations, neither of which you would expect in a typical public demonstration, at least in the United States. That's because they are less about protest than about being creative and generative, less about complaining than about declaring what you're committed to. The first is what I'd call a conversation for what matters. Here you talk about what's important to you, what you value, what you want to see present in the future you envision. The second is a possibility conversation. Here you build on what's important to you and discuss specific scenarios of how that might come to fruition. I don't know if anyone present in these conversations on the Maidan made this distinction that I'm making, but both types of conversations seem to have occurred. And this was happening during a time of dramatic events.
Annexation of Crimea, invasion of Russian forces into Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and so on.
In March 2014, Russia annexed Crimea. In April 2014, Russian troops invaded the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine.
To understand my personal shift, it was necessary to highlight one point. We ask each other what we did incorrectly, what was our mistake 10 years ago during Orange Revolution of 2004? Why 10 years ago during Orange Revolution of 2004, 2005, we did not reach our dreams? And we came to a very simple answer. Because after the revolution, we went back to our offices and homes. We decided that the revolution is over. The popular leader, that time President Yushchenko, has been elected, and we can go home.
He'll take care of it. We can do our businesses, return to the rest of our private lives.
Yeah, business as usual, life as usual. Yep, and in 2014, we got the point that we have no other choice. We could not go back home. And we decided that we have no the option to do this again. because we again will waste a decade.
We have no option. We have no option. We're going to learn from the past and do it differently.
Exactly, sir. We joined different reform teams to transform the country. Some people entered public service as top public servants in ministers. They became ministers, deputy ministers, and head of departments and other state bodies. Some people were elected as MPs. Some people joined different reform task forces of experts and advisors who helped to do specific political and economic and social transformation, to do all changes personally by their own brains and hands.
What did you personally do at that point?
I personally was elected as a member of so-called National Reform Council, regularly discussed and considered projects of reforms, projects of dramatic changes in political and economic systems, in legal systems. And also I joined a team of advisors of Minister of Economics that time, helping to transform the ministry into the Ministry of Economic was that time a very big post-Soviet bureaucratic system without any specific results provided. And we transformed it to a modern institution. Indeed, you can imagine that all these processes was absolutely unacceptable for Moscow, because that means that Ukraine finally broke the link to imperial tradition, to Soviet tradition, and joined European civilization.
So there's this amazing pattern of Ukrainian independence, sovereignty, freedom, and then dignity surging up, and then Moscow trying to fight back, push it down, repress it, replace it, poison. And then you have that surge of Ukrainian identity, freedom, pushing back out again. And in this case, very pivotal conversations in the Maidan, you said we have no choice. I mean, I'm just really struck by that moment of reflecting very soberly on what happened 10 years before. There was no requirement that you all look back and say what went wrong. Many people go through life not asking that question. And somehow groups of you, wasn't just one or two, asked that question. So I'm really want to just go back to that moment again, because it seems so pivotal. And what was your, could you just speak, I know you're a very humble person, but could you speak to what your part was in those facilitating those conversations?
Imagine that you are at Maidan Square in the cold winter of 2013-14, and you are surrounded by some hundreds of thousands, maybe 200-300 of thousands of people who permanently stay there, or who come just for day, go and then sleeping at home, or who stay just for night, then going to their job during daytime. Practically all the time, discussing, not just staying, heating themselves by some flames and drinking some tea or coffee or eating some sandwiches, but all the time discussing what to do and how to live further, because that was the essence of the gathering. Discussing in small groups, discussing in numerous conference halls of different office centers and hotels around Central Square. No one glass was broken. No one car was broken. To contribute to all these discussions, to contribute to civic education projects, to arrange different meetings of people from different bubbles and to facilitate their dialogues about what to do and how to transform the country after that. That was my job. Not only mine, there were a group of people from different business schools of the country around me, and we did that. And dignity means dignity in everything. Free economic freedom, human rights, rule of law, more democracy, decentralization, empowering communities, and many, many other things.
The war in eastern Ukraine was already in full swing, and Ukraine held democratic elections.
Poroshenko was elected.
Petro Poroshenko elected president in 2014.
And we sent him this package, and we invited him to a meeting. Imagine, we gathered 750 people, which contributed to this process of thinking about reforms and transitions. And we told him about strategies of these changes. It was something like 3.5 hours of conversation. And his idea, sometimes he agrees, he agreed, sometimes he declined. But his idea was very easy to understand. Guys and girls, if you would like these changes to be implemented, go and do this. You should join either government or parliament or reform task forces or something like different and do this, because there are no specific people in country which can do this. Nobody else can do this.
In a situation like this, where a political leader is met by demands from a vocal and organized group of citizens, that leader can respond in many ways. Ignore, resist, punish, you name it. President Poroshenko chose instead to offer an invitation, a challenge, and people responded.
So some people joined public service, either in the form of NGO activists, which spent practically full time for that, or as MPs or as government officials or other public servants.
This surge of civic activism in public service grew and grew. So by the time Russia made its full-scale invasion in February of 2022, the Ukrainian people had empowered themselves as citizens and were ready to respond.
So these horizontal networks contributed to dramatic resilience of the country. And the key word of last 2 years is resilience, because there were enough number of people who felt obliged to contribute to counter resilience. Some of them joined armed forces, some of them joined volunteering groups, as far as state institutions could not provide people with all this support which was necessary at that time. I'm trying to explain that this is exactly this postmodern progressive view, that there are so many pain around you, that there are so many suffering around you, you cannot simply go sleeping and forget about that. You could spend your free time, you can spend your free money, you can spend your competence. You should contribute yourself to decrease suffering, to decrease pain, because you cannot simply go home and drink coffee, your coffee and go sleep. So that's a very idealistic view indeed. But we believe, maybe mistakenly, we believe that this is exactly what European values are. Not to close your eyes if someone suffers, and to do this with enough respect to let these people to feel dignity.
How did speaking to people from all these different bubbles, how did that impact your view? How did it impact it, going from just being in an office to interacting with so many different people from different walks of life and ages and backgrounds? How did that shift your view?
Listen. First is listen. You should first listen, and then you can say something. And when you listen, you can learn that people speak different languages, not in terms of languages, I mean Ukrainian or French or English. No, different professional languages, different languages of different social groups. So when you speak to different people, you understand that there are numerous different worldviews.
This experience of engaged citizens coming together in freedom and dignity, Valery doesn't just view as a Ukrainian phenomenon. He sees it as a possible future for all people currently living under the rule of others.
The only way is to live in their own country and to deserve their own future and make their own future by their own brains and hands. So this story is not ended. This story isn't finished. We will come finally to the freedom of all nations which empire ever colonized. And then their first word now is like Ukrainian first word in 1991, freedom. And then they will fight after some 10, 20 years. They will then go next step for dignity.
Reflections. What do you take from Valerie's story? What here was new for you, either about Ukraine and its history, or about the process of changing worldviews that Valerie spoke of? I'm going to keep my comments brief this time, but let me say two things. First, on a few occasions in the first part of the story, Valerie's answer surprised me. Big events were happening around him, and I was expecting him to say that they inspired him to care about the country and the nation, to take more civic pride. But instead, he reported that his focus at that time was primarily on him as an individual, primarily on his business and the people closest to him. That surprised me. But there's a reason for this, and Valerie talks about it multiple times. It shows up in the field of adult development. We human adults grow in a particular sequence. Before we start to care about others on an interior level, we first need to break free from traditional structures, from that sense of having to sacrifice ourselves to some larger whole, and establish our own individuality. Everyone goes through this, and the sequence matters. And this is true even for someone like Valerie, who in many ways, although he's too humble to put it this way, was a step ahead of the rest of his country. Now, my second observation is about one of our favorite subjects here on the podcast, which is moods. As a quick refresher, moods are persistent emotional states that are often intermingled with assessments of the future. A few moods that you'll recognize are resentment, resignation, and anxiety. Or if we're talking about constructive moods, curiosity or ambition, which is the mood of we can do this. Moods, this is very important to say, are not the same as emotions. Emotions are more like the weather, constantly changing, coming and going. In contrast, moods are more like the climate of a region, relatively persistent over time, and this is true even amidst climate change. So, when Valerie describes what he experienced in 2014 on the Maidan, where hundreds of thousands of people gathered for months, often in sub-zero temperatures, and thousands of these folks talked about the future, he's describing a particular mood. It's a mood of possibility, of curiosity, of ambition. And nobody just handed the Ukrainians this mood, and they certainly weren't born with it. There was nothing inevitable about it. The Ukrainians generated this mood together by facing adversity and by facing it together in a particular way. They did two things. First, they accepted the brutal facts of what was happening in their country. And two, they committed themselves to a creative response. So for you and me, I've got to wonder, if folks like that can generate positive, constructive moods when their country is in amazing turmoil and they're outside in sub-zero temperatures, how about us? Now, it's not easy with crises all around, and I can get as grumpy as anyone else. But at some point, doesn't it make sense to pause, take a deep breath or two, and say to ourselves, hey, what those Ukrainians did, that mood that generated that feeling of togetherness and agency and ambition and curiosity, maybe I'd like to get a taste of that too. And maybe I'd like to share it with the people around me. Thanks for listening. If you believe in this show, like what you're hearing, or simply don't know what to do with yourself for the next 60 seconds, please leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This show is produced in Detroit by Zach Rosen.